everyone, and welcome to another episode of West Obsessed, where the writers and editors of High Country News come together to discuss issues crucial to the health of the American West. West Obsessed is a collaboration between High Country News and KVNF Community Radio in Paonia, Colorado. I'm Kate Schimmel, HCN's Deputy Editor Digital. In today's episode, we're asking one of the big questions in life, in the world. So what if we're doomed? Editor-in-Chief Brian Calvert is here to talk about it with me. He just wrote about it for our latest issue of the magazine. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks, Kate. I'm very excited to be here to talk about whether or not we're doomed.
And what to do if we are, right?
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Well, let's start by talking about whether we're doomed. Can you tell us a little bit about how you see where we are right now? As a planet? As a planet.
Well, since I know everything there is to know about this planet, I would say I'm not sure yet whether or not we're doomed. But I did want to write a story that asked the question, what if we're doomed? And if you are a person who thinks that Western civilization or the human race in general is not really going to make it very much farther, that we've sort of painted ourselves into a corner with the way we treat the world and each other. Our systems are like this big machine of a human system that we've built. If you're a person who believes that that machine is not going to stop going until it's basically eradicated everything we need on this earth to survive, is that a valid feeling? And if it is a valid feeling, what do you do with it? And so I wanted to sort of inhabit that space and figure out if there's a way through that feeling that isn't just the pure nihilistic abyss.
Why avoid a nihilistic abyss?
Well, I guess it depends on who you are. You don't have to if you don't want to. But I don't really want to go through life personally feeling like nothing I do matters. And yet, I don't necessarily believe that the human race is going to make it. So where is the sanity in that? How do you live a life in service to something inside of that belief or that despair?
Hmm. We've been talking about this story for
a long time.
2 years now?
Yeah.
And one of the questions I've always had is, when did you first start thinking of this human machine as something that might be inevitable?
You know, I spent an early part of my career as a foreign correspondent, and I worked in conflict or post-conflict countries. And I went abroad somewhat naively looking to see how the world worked and to see how I could write about people in the world and that, you know, like our sort of our commonalities or our, you know, it was very sort of an idealistic vision of writing about, oh, if people just understood each other, we'd be a lot better off. And somewhere along the way, I kind of realized that we're a lot more different than we think and that we really have in place a lot of sort of violent machinery that seems self-perpetuating. So part of it, I think, comes from, you know, exposing myself to, I mean, not in the legal sense.
of encountering
parts of the world where there wasn't a lot of great stuff going on. You know, for example, working in Cambodia for off and on almost a total of 7 years, the place, you know, the site of the 20th century's worst sort of genocide, it's not a great place to see hope in humanity. But, you know, I left that career behind and wanted to sort of focus on the environmental catastrophe that we're facing. And I kind of thought that that would be like a healthier way to live and that you'd be hanging around with people who were, you know, excited to be outdoors and, you know, your sort of field biologists and other kinds of researchers, climatologists that are out there sort of like measuring snowpack and albedo and swish, swish, swish on their skis and, you know, dark tans and bright teeth and, you know, those kind of folks. See you Boulder people.
You were looking for those healthy Westerners.
Yeah. I wanted to be around healthy Westerners and then just sort of like examine or explore how climate change might be changing the American West. That was kind of how I decided to come back from my work abroad. And to do that, I started talking to a lot of researchers and people who are looking at the climate change question from a very empirical scientific standpoint. And what you learn when you talk to enough of those people is that there are very few scenarios in which the humans come out of this looking pretty good.
I think it says something about you that you decided that the genocide and war was too much, and so you were going to pick it up with ecological devastation and climate change.
Yeah, just to leaven it a little.
I feel like, you know, there were maybe a few other choices at that moment in time that would have been a sure bet.
Yeah, I could have been an architect, I guess.
Or a gardener.
Yeah. Well, have you seen my garden? My neighbors will tell you. I could not have been a gardener. No chance. Zero opportunity for that.
So you started talking to these researchers, and they started to paint a picture where there were very few scenarios to get where. I mean, I think that's one of the interesting things. What is the road through that you were looking for when you were talking to them?
Yeah, I mean, without exaggerating, where I do take some rhetorical exaggerations in this piece, we may not necessarily be headed towards a world of sunblasted barbarism, but the different international climate research sort of scenarios, the IPCC scenarios, they sort of list different ways of like the different types of warming that we may experience under a certain regime of CO2 emissions, let's say, or greenhouse gas emissions. And looking at the implications of those scenarios, thinking about a world where and worst case scenario is a lot of sea level rise, a lot of biodiversity loss, and potentially a lot of crop failure and food problems for our species.
So more people squeezed into less space with less food.
Yes. And more competition over a lot of different resources, including water, space, food. The scenarios that you can imagine from business as usual, i.e. if we don't get any of our spit together and solve some of these climate change problems or greenhouse gas emissions problems, they don't look good for improved life, let's say, for our future generations. And so it gets into some very abstract, difficult ethical dimensions. But I think I feel what a lot of other people feel, which is that it's easy to imagine some pretty horrific things coming down for humans.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. A woman was doing this project where she basically taped parents talking to their kids about climate change. And I thought that was such an interesting project for that exact reason. Both my parents are climate scientists. And I always wondered growing up what it was like for them to make the choice to have kids and to raise them knowing what was coming. And I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. I've actually never asked them. But I think that's hanging over a lot of people's head right now. What are they bringing their kids or their friends or their nephews into the world?
Yeah, I mean, there's some great writing being done on that, specifically on the sort of ethical dimensions of bringing someone into this world. And one of the answers to that is that this is a dangerous world always. And you're always, you know, by bringing someone into it, you're exposing someone to danger that didn't have a choice in the matter, didn't have a say, depending on your spiritual beliefs. I'm pretty sure everyone can agree that a baby doesn't really have like a lot of say in coming into the world. The point is generally in that line of thinking that if you are bringing someone into the world that way, you have to be responsible for their safety in a way. And so the answer to that ethically is that yes, you can bring someone into a dangerous world as long as you're working to sort of safeguard them through and shepherd them through a certain number of years until they can be responsible for themselves. I'm still working on that part, so it could be up to 42 years, as far as I know, before someone can be responsible for themselves. Some people get there sooner. But the point with this climate chaos, or the environmental catastrophe larger, or what I call in this piece the ecocide, which is basically the destruction of our home, is that you don't have control over it necessarily. As you cannot guarantee the safety of these future generations in a way that you could under other questions. And so it becomes a lot more interesting question. I'd love to hear from your parents too. What did they tell you about life on Earth, you know, as you were growing up?
Well, I think they maybe had a sort of suite of answers. You know, not every answer answered every question I had, but one was they're very optimistic people and they're very hardworking. And they, to this day, think that there's a way for me and for future generations to grow up in a safer, more whole world. And at the same time, I think they spent a huge amount of time in the woods, and they took us into the woods, me and my siblings. And I sort of hope that what they were trying to instill is, like, you know, this is your place. This is your place to shepherd. And I know when I was very lost in college and trying to figure out what I was going to do, my dad told me that he chose science because it was a way of understanding the world and trying to do good in meaningful ways. And I thought I think that is an interesting parallel to the ideas you put forward, which is science is not activism. He wasn't trying to do anything other than understand what was going on around him and see how it worked and find beauty in that. And I kind of wanted to push you a little bit on that idea. Is that if you're no longer safeguarding future generations physically, in a way, I see this as an attempt to safeguard future generations and these generations that currently are living, their sense of beauty, their sense of awe, their sense of curiosity.
Yeah, I think what I mostly wanted to do in this piece is think about naming what this feeling is that I have, which I call a kind of grief, a sort of low register grief for a loss yet to come. And identifying that as grief and not necessarily as a sort of anxiety or worry, which I think is different. I think that's a different thing.
Could you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, I think anxiety, I mean, I'm not sure if you're familiar with anxiety, Kate.
No, not at all. Not at all. I've never experienced anxiety.
You're not an anxious person. Well, I'm more of a brooder. I don't really get anxious about things. I kind of look back on things and I feel bad about, I feel grief often for lost loved ones or people I've known in these other parts of the world that have much worse lives than I have. And that's a different feeling from being worried about what's going to happen next or tomorrow. And so I've heard this idea of eco-anxiety before, but I don't feel anxious about what's coming. I feel sad about what's coming. I feel like we've already lost so much because so much is in motion in this climate system that it just lives closer to grief. But it's a really low register grief, but it can be kind of paralyzing in a nihilistic way. If you think that, like, there are so many things set in motion that we're just going to lose a ton of stuff before things even start to level off, whether that's species or people's sanity or, you know, if we're heading into some sort of dystopia, you can feel sad about that. But is there a way to still be meaningful inside of that feeling? And so I think the way that people overcome grief is different than the way people overcome anxiety.
That's fascinating. I don't think I'd ever understood your thinking on that before.
Well, I only spent 6,000 words trying to explain it. So sorry.
Oh, I didn't read it. I'm sorry,
that wasn't clear. Yeah.
No. But I think the distinction between how you respond to grief and how you respond to anxiety as being really different. And at the same time, to me, there's some commonalities. It's in quiet. It's in beauty. It's in moments of just being where you are. I'd like, I think, first for you to explain how you first understood that you were grieving.
Well, it was interesting because I came back from 6 months in Afghanistan. I moved to Southern California. I lived with my sister for a while, which I think she and I would both agree was not a great idea, but I didn't know where else to go. So after living with my sister and her family for 6 months, I moved to the coast, closer to the coast. In my time abroad, I had learned to surf, and so I found that to be a very good activity in terms of assuaging some of the feelings that I had from the places that I'd been. So I had worked in Cambodia and Sri Lanka during its sort of war period, and I'd been in Afghanistan twice. I'd been in Ramallah. I'd covered an insurgency in southern Thailand. I'd kind of been in some rough places in Papua New Guinea. Lived in China, which is a slightly different thing, but I had seen a lot of people who had been pretty much torn up by war or political violence of one kind or another. I'd had sources of mine assassinated. I'd known people who died or their relatives died of either disease or just dumb stuff in poor countries. And surfing was this way of, like, because when you're in Southern California, you can't really be in nature very easily. It's a little bit of a haul just to get out to Joshua Tree or kind of like the baked San Bernardino Mountains. But the ocean is a great place. You just turn your back on America, paddle out, and then you're just facing the wild Pacific Ocean, and wind waves are coming in, and you know, you're getting stung by things, and you know, there's little sharks underneath you, and dolphins, and you know, there's just like a wild world. Pelicans and grebes and things are just smashing into the water and gobbling up fish, and I always just felt like it was kind of a wild place, and I like to go out surfing on kind of wild days, rainy days or foggy days, and the waves are coming in and the riptides are kind of nuts, and you know, that's not necessarily the most peaceful way to surf, but I found that way to connect with like a wild world, and that seemed to like really help. And I think that's sort of what led me more towards sort of like wanting to look more into environmental writing. So in that, it's sort of like what about that is helpful? And it's kind of hard to say really at first, but I was still sort of trying to figure out what I was going to cover as a journalist. And so I had a lot of experience with Cambodians. And after the Newtown shooting in Connecticut, I went to Stockton, where there was a enclave of Cambodians and Vietnamese who I knew had undergone a similar mass shooting 24 years earlier. So I was up there interviewing them and, you know, sort of living in Southern California and living this kind of weird sort of surfy pseudo-journalistic life. I think it was not quite making enough money to be living where I was living, but I was kind of, it was doing okay. You know, I hadn't maxed out the credit cards yet, I guess.
That came later.
Yeah, just get more credit cards. That's how you prevent maxing out on credit cards, Kate. Pro tip.
Financial money. Advice from the editors of High Country News.
Credit cards, free money.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to West Obsessed, a collaboration between High Country News and KVNF, where we discuss issues critical to the American West and apparently your financial health. I'm Kate Schimmel, here with Brian Calvert, talking about grief, credit cards.
So I had this, I was living this life where I was kind of getting out into the natural world in a way, but I was still very much tethered to this world of grief and sorrow. And so to talk to Cambodian parents who'd survived war and genocide and refugee camps and had made it to America and then had their children, their hope for the future. And, you know, in a Cambodian society, that's all you really have sometimes where you're like, you're just really working for your children to sort of their future. And to have that like ripped away by a gunman, that was really, really hard on me. And I, some of this didn't go into the piece I wrote, but you know, after that, I did end up like, I went for a hike in Muir Woods, and I went, I camped out at Pinnacles on my way home. And, you know, just that sort of juxtaposition of feeling this kind of sorrow and grief for these people who had lost their, for these parents. And then the effect that sort of nature just has on you to sort of put that into a little bit of perspective was kind of on my mind. And then when I got back to Southern California, my little apartment, I came across this writer named Paul Kingsnorth, and he was a guy who called himself a recovering environmentalist and was basing a lot of, and he sort of had this sort of dark vision of like, okay, what do you do? You know, sort of these questions that I was asking also, I think of myself, which is like, what do you do if you feel this way? And I think what's really interesting in the climate question is we've sort of left all of this stuff about the future to either our scientists to try to figure it out and tell us what's going on, or our journalists to try to help explain the scientists, or our policymakers who have to decide on who they're going to listen to inside of that debate. But there's really no engagement from the artistic world, or philosophers, or our writers, or our poets, or our musicians. No one, you know, because it's such a weird abstract thing to think about, that whole swath of humanity isn't really fully engaged yet in this crisis, or yeah, this ecological crisis. So here was a guy who was sort of trying to get artists and writers to think about it. Like, what do you do if we, you know, if the stories that we've been telling ourselves as a society or the human race, the myth of progress, for example, that we must as humans go from, you know, cave dwellers to, you know, Star Trek Enterprise caliber, you know, shiny ships and clean suits and teleportation, and, you know, that sort of myth of progress. What if that's wrong? What if we shouldn't be doing that? What if we shouldn't be doubling down on technology every single time we have a problem? Because every time we build up technology, it sort of gets us into a ratcheted, more difficult situation. What do you do with that? And he was basing a lot of his thinking on a California poet named Robinson Jeffers, whose poetry sort of predated the deep ecologist sort of environmental movement, the sort of the thing that says, hey, the earth has this sort of moral equivalence to humans. We shouldn't just like rip it up and kill everything and do everything for our own advancement as humans. And inside of that, I just started, kind of got obsessed with this poet whose work really focuses on that idea, which he called inhumanism, which was to say, you should love human beings not apart from nature, but as a part of this big, big natural system that's very, very beautiful. And when I started to think about what makes something beautiful and what made his work beautiful, he's got like a really sophisticated defense of it, which is that in the big picture, the cosmos that we live in, the universe that we live in, over time, is a system that is beautiful. And inside of that, there are many, many ugly things, but that's no reason to despair, and that's no reason to ignore beauty. And so it seems to me that when you are developing an appreciation of beauty, and especially in the natural world or the wild world, when you're building an appreciation for that, what you're actually doing is you're uncentering yourself from yourself, from your own sort of narcissistic worries and woes, and you're seeing yourself as a part of a larger system that's been going on for a very, very long time. And somehow I just found some kind of relief in that. And so I just wanted to write a piece that explored that, because it's not super prescriptive, but if you're doing something in the service of beauty, that can be meaningful. And if you can find some meaning in this sort of despair, then probably you can do some more useful things for people around you.
Hmm. Yeah. In my own interpretation of your thoughts, the way I think about it is not worrying so much about what the effects of your actions are, but trying to do right in a moment-to-moment basis. Sort of accepting human as creature rather than human as intellectual, human as God, even human as artist. It's human as creature. We are going along day to day as creatures, and you try and be a good creature most days, but some days you're not. And the ripple out of those actions isn't so important. And then it's so interesting because right at the end you come back to, but part of the reason for doing that is to be of use, is to have your actions be more effective and more meaningful and contribute.
Yeah, because I felt like in that examination of beauty, it wasn't far enough. It didn't go far enough because we're in an age of, you know, terrible violence, human-on-human violence. And so if you're just going to sit back and say, oh, well, I'll just be in service to beauty, you're not really doing much for the, you know, movement like Black Lives Matter or the Syrian conflict or drone strike. I mean, you know, you're not really being in service to other humans in a way. And so that was kind of where this piece led me, was to think that, you know, if you can accept the eco side and sort of get to the acceptance part of grief there through beauty, what you can also do is understand the idea of justice as a healing of injury, or a beauty and justice both as a pursuit of integrity of this larger system, then you're really getting somewhere in being meaningful. I mean, there's no prescriptive if we're doomed, and I'm not saying that we are, I'm just saying that I believe we are based on all the evidence.
And perhaps you should believe this too.
But if you just don't think that, oh, things just have to get better because they're so bad, that's a terrible position to be in. But if you can say, like, you know what, we might not make it as a human race 25 million years from now, things are going to be fine. But in the meantime, I'm going to do things in my life to be meaningful that are either in service of beauty or justice. And together that's creating some kind of healing of injury. That's a very good way to go through the world. So, you know, if you wanted to refuse to mow your lawn so that it can grow wild, and
you wouldn't
like
be
some
speaking.
People we know. Sorry, town of Peonia.
It's okay.
Sorry for those weeds, but it's a philosophical statement that I look forward to having that discussion with someone eventually. But
town council.
Yes. If you're doing something in service of the wild world, you're healing a kind of injury from the machinery of dominion that has taken away wild somewhere else. So you're serving justice in that way. If you are more into social justice and you're marching for people's rights, or you're petitioning against police brutality, you're actually creating something beautiful in the world because you're also serving integrity. You're healing injury. And if that's really what it takes to sort of go through day to day, to do something right, I think that's a good ethic. It doesn't mean that we're, you know, because our society is so outcome based all the time. What did you do? What did you produce? What good did that do? What good is it? What good is it to recycle? Not a lot, but it's right. It's the right thing to do because you're sort of rebalancing something. And so being obsessed about the outcome in the age of ecocide can lead you, I think, to insanity, nihilism, falling into the abyss, whatever you want to call it. But if you want to accept the eco side and then be in service to beauty or justice, which is the integrity of this larger system, then I think you're doing okay.
Well, thanks for that, Brian.
Anytime, Kate.
I think we are out of time. But if you want to chew on more regarding the eco side, how to face it, what to make of it, and exactly how many species we're likely to lose, you can check out everything we've got at hcn.org. To continue this conversation online, visit kvnf.org. And thanks, Brian, for talking to me about death, about grief, and about your maxed out credit cards.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, Kate.
For West Obsessed, I'm Kate Schimmel, the deputy editor digital at High Country News. Thanks for listening.